Well, happy Easter, everyone. If I haven't met you, my name is Nate, and I'm just so happy that you are here. So here's what we're about today is there aren't many things that like continue for thousands of years. And most things, they kind of come and go. They're passing fads. Easter is one of those things that for 2,000 years, in every culture you can imagine, even today, in dusty little huts without electricity, in magnificent cathedrals, people are gathering together and they are commemorating, they're remembering an event that we believe literally changes human potential. It changes history, changes everything, is that death no longer has power, that God came to earth. He so desired to reconnect with humanity that he said, you can never do it by yourself, so I will do it. So Jesus lives a life that we couldn't live. Obedient, submitted, and then he dies in our place. And if the story ended there, it'd be pretty good news. Like, sin's taken care of. But it goes a step further. 3 days later, Jesus emerged from the grave, resurrected. And that Christianity, this thing that we call Christianity, is not a historical religion. We're not just remembering someone who lived. We literally believe that Jesus is alive, that he is still working today. So that is Easter. That's the story. That's the beauty of Easter. And that's why for 2,000 years, people have been celebrating. Easter's like, I love jelly beans, especially the Starburst ones. Oh, Lordy. But man, without resurrection, Easter's empty calories. All right. So that's what we're all about. Even if you're here and you're a little bit skeptical, thanks for coming. I know when you talk about resurrected from the dead, some of us are like, yeah, that's okay. Would you explore the story and just kind of open yourself up to the story a little bit and see what God might say to you? So we are actually going to look at a passage of scripture that happens before Jesus' resurrection. It's about 2.5 months before Jesus is going to experience his resurrection. It's written in a book called John. It's written by the Apostle John, one of the men that lived life with Jesus. And he records this instance where Jesus encounters a family who is, they're just devastated. They're absolutely devastated. And he's going to come face to face with death. And the beauty of it is it's a precursor. It's a precursor to his own resurrection. And this is one of the main questions I like to deal with. It'd be this. What do you do when you feel like God has let you down? When you're a bit disillusioned? When you'd say this, maybe, I have prayed, I have hoped, I've kept the faith, and it doesn't seem like God has kept up his end of the bargain. I've longed for something different. I live my life a certain way, and it seems like God hasn't shown up. What do you do in the midst of disillusionment? Now, I think that's a question that everybody in the room asks themselves. Even if you have no idea what you believe, you're spiritually unresolved, you've wondered that. And for all of us who have walked with Jesus for years, we've still struggled with this. What happens when we're a bit disillusioned by what God does and doesn't do? So let's read this story together. It's about a family, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. They're three siblings. They live in a little village called Bethany. And this has been one of the places that Jesus has frequented often. In fact, it appears that when he's in this region, he stays at their home. Jesus is in this itinerant mission where he's traveling around teaching, so he's very close to this family. Let's read as they just experience their own tragedy, and Jesus interacts with their tragedy. Now, a man named Lazarus was sick. This wasn't a cold, okay? He didn't have the flu. This is a serious sickness. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. You'll read that just a little bit farther along in the book of John. She's so grateful for what's about to happen. So the sisters sent word to Jesus. Lord, the one you love is sick. Okay? Now they're putting a little pressure on him. Okay, Lazarus is sick, and we want you to remember something. You love him. You are close to him. And when he heard this, Jesus said, this is where it starts getting a little transrational, okay? He's going to make some statements, and it's going to leave everybody's head scratching a little bit. This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. So Jesus is saying this. There's a story that everyone's going to experience, but the ending is not what anyone anticipates. There's something bigger happening here. God is going to do something in this situation that is going to make people pause and reconsider who I am, Jesus says. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, what would you expect? He immediately said to his disciples, "We have to go to Bethany." No. When he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. If you called 911 and you said, "I need help now," and they said this, "We love you, we'll be there in 2 days." You're like, wait a minute. This is inconsistent. You love me and you're gonna wait? No, this is serious. That's exactly what Jesus does. And then he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." Judea is, in chapter 10, the chapter just before this, he healed a man who was born blind, and the religious community freaked out and they tried to execute him. "But Rabbi, teacher," they said, "a short while ago the Jews there tried to stone you, and yet you're going back?" Let's talk a little bit about 4 different groups in this story that are experiencing disillusionment. They feel like God hasn't shown up. He's not meeting their expectations. The first would have to be Lazarus. John doesn't record what's going on in Lazarus's mind. But can you imagine this? You are sick, and instinctively you know this is not good, and your sickness is progressing, and the doctors have come, and people have been praying. And here's what your sisters say to you. They whisper in your ear, "Hang on, Lazarus. We told Jesus. He's coming. He's coming." And Lazarus lives multiple days holding on for the arrival of Jesus, but Jesus never comes. And then you have the disillusionment that Mary and Martha are experiencing. They put in the call. They had relationship with Jesus. They expected him to immediately respond, but he doesn't. Let's read what Martha says in verse 20 and 21. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, so he finally comes, she went out to meet him. But Mary didn't even want to see Jesus. Her brother has already died. She stayed at home. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, if you would have answered our call, if you would have responded the way that we would anticipate that you would respond, if you would have paid attention, if you had cared, my brother would not have died." However, look at this. She says, "But I know that even now, after my brother's dead, even now after it's too late, God will give you whatever you ask." Mary and Martha experienced belief mixed with resentment. Belief mixed with resentment. And I think that actually describes a lot of people. A lot of us, we hold on to belief, like, yeah, we believe, but we feel disappointed. We feel disillusioned about where we are at in life. We feel as if God hasn't held up his end of the bargain. And so there's this low-grade resentment that emanates towards God. Then there's somebody else in the story. We haven't even read about him yet. His name's Thomas. And Thomas is despondent but committed. Okay, let's read what Thomas says in verse 16. Then Thomas, called Didymus. So Thomas in Hebrew means twin. Didymus in Greek means twin. So we get our words ditto, duplicate. So then Thomas, called Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, and I do not believe that you can read this without an Eeyore voice, okay? "Let us also go, that we may die with him." Thomas, you have anybody in your life, I call them positive challenged. Like, you go like, "Whoa, it's a beautiful sunny day. Look how blue the sky is." And they say, "Tornadoes often come out of blue skies." Like, "Look at the birds. birds carry disease. You're like, stop it. Like, come on. This is Thomas. He, later on, after Jesus dies and resurrects, the first time he shows up to his 10 remaining disciples, or 11, Thomas isn't in the room. And Thomas comes back, and they're all, he said, what happened? He goes, hey, while you were gone, Jesus came. He's alive. And he looks at them. So these are his 11 friends. And he says, liars. Like, I'll never believe that. So his nickname is actually Doubting Thomas. So if you're skeptical, there's somebody that followed Jesus that was also skeptical, right? So your skepticism doesn't keep you from following Jesus. So Thomas says, listen, I'll never believe that he's resurrected. I saw him die. I'm rational. I would never believe it unless I could put my finger in the holes that the nails made. A few days later, Jesus shows up again. Thomas is there this time. And Jesus says, hey, Thomas, I heard what you said. Would you like to put your fingers in my wounds? And Thomas says, no, thank you. He's like, no. So here you have somebody like Thomas, and how would we describe him? He's despondent but committed, right? I didn't sign up for this. We're gonna lose our lives. Jesus is living his life in a way that I don't understand. I wanted to see a new kingdom. I wanted to see things change. He's despondent but committed. And then lastly, there's the crowd. There's a crowd of people. Here's what would have happened at a first century funeral. Jewish belief was this, is that when someone died, their spirit remained in close proximity to their body for 3 days. And so you would have 3 days of intensive mourning. Where, like, verbally, you'd cry aloud. And it was for this reason, is that you believed that that person's spirit was there and they could hear everything you said. And on the fourth day then, that person's spirit left. So people had gathered from all over. And they're there with Mary and they're there with Martha and they're mourning the loss of Lazarus. Look at what the crowd says when Jesus shows up. Some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Cynicism. It's critical. They are asking a question that human beings have been asking since the beginning of time. Why do bad things happen to good people? Why doesn't God take care of everything that's rotten and broken in this world? Why is there so much pain? Why is there so much brokenness? So they're critical. So the question is this. Jesus shows up 4 days late. He's got Mary and Martha who are angry. He's got Thomas who's depressed. He's got the crowds who are critical. And there's Lazarus who's no longer even there. How does God respond to human pain? How does he respond to people who doubt him or are resentful towards him? You'd imagine that Jesus would have every right to say, hey, everybody, like, stop it. It's gonna be okay. But Jesus doesn't. This is how he responds to human pain, to our sense of disillusionment. When Jesus saw Martha weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. He knows what's gonna happen. But he hurts because people hurt. He hurts because he knows how terrible and ugly life can be. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. And Jesus wept. Two words. In fact, this is the shortest verse in the New Testament. If you want to say to somebody, hey, I memorized a verse this Easter, this is it, one verse. Jesus wept. But think of how profound those two words are. It means that God is not distant. He's not removed. He's not hardened. This isn't some deistic worldview where he created it all and now he's just a passive observer. That Jesus hurts for people. That what has happened on this planet is not part of his intention. That he identifies with our sense of loss. Jesus wept with Mary and with Martha. That's how he responds to human pain. Now, as we move on in the chapter, Jesus makes two statements and then asks a question. Okay, it's just this moment of, wow. I've been to a lot of funerals over the course of my life. And I still never know what to say. It just doesn't seem like there's any words that can alleviate what people are experiencing. What Jesus says at this funeral is something I know you're not supposed to say at funerals. Okay? This is what he says. Let's read this together. Jesus said to her, "I am. Ego and me." This is an ancient principle. We first see it in Exodus chapter 3, where Moses says, "Who are you, God?" He says, "I am. I am the resurrection and the life." So resurrection isn't a formula. Resurrection isn't a diet. You can be super vegan and you're still gonna die, all right? 100% mortality rate on the face of this planet, except for one person. He says, if you want resurrection, if you want life, he makes this incredibly bold statement. It's in me. I am the resurrection and the life, the one who believes in me. Now, he's going to use this belief. He says, I'm the resurrection and life, and the thing that connects you with me, the resurrection and life, is this thing called belief. He who believes in me will live even though they die. This is exactly what's happened to Lazarus. He believed, but he still died. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Jesus is alluding to this future. He says belief in him, the resurrection of life, has eternal implications. There's sure physical death, but there's resurrection as well. And then here's his question. This is a question that is easy to answer when everything is going well. It's much more difficult to answer when you are standing next to the grave of your brother and you're frustrated and angry at Jesus. Jesus says, "Do you believe this?" Ladies and gentlemen, I think this is the question. I think this is the most important question that human beings must deal with. Jesus looks us in the eyes. And he says, "Do you believe? Do you believe that I'm resurrection? Do you believe that I'm life? I know Lazarus is still in the tomb. I know that you've had pain, but do you believe that there's something bigger out there?" So we move on in the chapter. It's going to get even a little bit stranger. You ready? Jesus is going to start speaking to the dead. Right? He's going to have a conversation with a dead man. Let's read verse 38. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time, there's a bad odor, for he's been in there for 4 days. Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." He's saying, what is about to happen, Father? This is to help people understand what's happening. And when he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. And Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." Let him go. This all begins with Jesus speaking to a dead man. Do you notice Martha and her objections? I can relate to those objections. Jesus, You just ask them to move the stone from in front of the grave. I'm already struggling. This, you want to make a bad situation worse? My brother's going to stink. I know what happens when things die. You can't reverse this. There's no second chances. It's been too much time. Jesus, you didn't come soon enough. There's things back there that are dead and decayed. And I think we all relate to that. We think, God, it's too late for me. It's too late for this marriage. It's too late. I've struggled with this addiction for years and years. I've made too many mistakes. I'm unlovable. I've gone too far. You could never fix that. That thing is dead. Keep it. Hide it. Don't let it out. Let it stay buried. And here's what Jesus does. He stands in front of the mouth of our grave, with all the dead things that exist in our life. And he calls out, John, come out. Elizabeth, come out. He speaks resurrection life. Now, today, it's the resurrected Jesus, the one who conquered death. And he stands in front of our grave and he says, come forward. It's never too late. There's the possibility of resurrection. There's the hope of forgiveness. There's the opportunity to live again. This can be fixed. This can be restored. What was doesn't always have to be. There can be a new future. That's the story of Easter. That's the story of Jesus standing in front of my grave, my emptiness, my darkness, and calling out life, speaking life to dead men and to dead women. There's one part of this story that it seems so peculiar. I want to ask my friend Kelly to come out here because he's going to help us walk through this. So, I mean, there's just way too many movies out there these days having to do with mummies, right? So the minute we were reading through that, some of us were like, what in the world? Why in the world does Jesus call out Lazarus? And he shows up, but he's still wrapped up. So Lazarus would have been completely wrapped up. Think of a mummy, all right? That's how they dealt with death in the first century. And when he's resurrected, he's still wrapped. When Jesus resurrected, one of the little details, the writers tell us that his grave clothes were folded and left behind. But when Lazarus comes out, So there are very clear prohibitions in the Jewish law that you never interact with a corpse. Because if you do, then you're committed to uncleanness and you have to go through this long ritual of making yourself clean. So what is going on here? Because Jesus resurrects and now you have a wrapped, resurrected man. And Jesus says to the people around him, I want you to go and unwrap him. Jesus does the miracle of resurrection. He includes the people around you in the process of being unwrapped. Has anybody ever wondered why churches are dysfunctional? You ever? This is why. You've got resurrected people who still need to be unwrapped from their sin. You've got resurrected people who still need healing from their pain. And uniquely, he asks us to allow ourselves to be unwrapped, to be involved in the process of unwrapping other people. And this, my friends, is a lifetime. This is why the world is imperfect. God's resurrected. There's a new start. But the process of unwrapping from addiction takes time. It takes community. It takes effort. Process of unwrapping from death involves the people around us. Thanks, Kelly. Resurrected and wrapped. Jesus stands at the mouth of our cave. And by name, your name, come forth. Live again. I conquered death so that you could live with me. Do you believe that I am resurrection and I am life? Will you pray with me? The resurrection means that what was no longer has to be. It means hope. It means nothing is too far gone. There's not been too much water under the bridge. It means that there are new starts and new beginnings. And for people who are disillusioned at times, sometimes frustrated at God, you cry with us, you weep with us, and you speak life into the caverns of our life and call us forward. Call us forward into freedom. You call us forward into life and into hope. And God, you're patient with us in the process of being unwrapped. We commit ourselves to being unwrapped. We commit ourselves to unwrapping the people around us because the miracle has happened. New life. The resurrected Jesus calls our names. I wonder if you keep your eyes closed for just a moment. I want to give space and an opportunity for anybody in the room. Some of us right now, the question that Jesus asked Martha, he's asking you this morning. Your heart's beating. You just know he's asking you. He says, I am resurrection, I am life. And he looks you in the eyes. He knows exactly where you're at, what you've done. And he forgives you. And he says this, do you believe this? Do you believe that I'm alive, that I give second chances, that I could resurrect what's dead inside of you? Do you believe? For any of us who would say, today's the day, I'm going to draw a line in the sand. I'm solidifying. I'm saying, yes, I believe. Would you boldly do this? Would you just raise your hand and wave at me? I want to catch your eye. This is a resurrection moment. Yes. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Beautiful. Anybody? All three of you right here, yes, ma'am. Your sons and daughters, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am, you're forgiven. You're loved, yes, yes, yes. All three of you right there. Over on my left, your right, yeah. Yes, yes. I see your hands here as well. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, absolutely. We're right back here, yeah. Okay, both of you, I see you. Beautiful. If you're in the balcony, would you wave at me? I want to agree, yeah. All right, I love it. Yes, yes. Yes, yes, yes. All right, yeah, I see your hand, young lady. You're his. Yes, sir. You're his. Come out, he says. Come forward, be whole. Yes, I see your hand. Oh. Hey, everybody, would you applaud for a resurrection moment that a whole bunch of people have experienced? Woo-hoo. That is beautiful.